The chair calls the Minnesota House Committee on Public Safety and Criminal Justice Reform to order. Today we've got a couple things that we're going to do. We've got one, two, three, four bills related to youth and public safety. I'm going to ask Representative Christensen to make her way up to the testifiers table. And then this evening we're going to have this is a joint hearing, yes. Right? A joint hearing with our subcommittee on corrections to go through the corrections budget presentation. I'm hoping, frankly, that that'll be not a very lengthy committee hearing time, but we want to make sure that we're giving the appropriate amount of time to go through that budget. Representative Johnson, as you know, it's probably the biggest chunk of this division's budget, so it's important that we focus carefully in on that. With that, Representative Christensen, you have House File 950, and I believe your motion is to lay over House File 950 for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
So moved.
Very well. And so, members and Representative Christensen, House File 950 is before us.
Thank you, Chair Mariani, and thank you, members. Thank you, all of our visitors. I'm here as a retired school teacher and a member of the Public Safety Committee to talk about Minnesota school safety centers. It's something that we're all familiar with. We heard the commissioner come in and talk with us about school safety centers and the funding needed for it. So we're here today to ask for the same funding that the governor asked for. Security assessment, emergency planning, and training for public schools. The Minnesota Safety Center provides family security assessments, emergency plan reviews, active shooter, violent intruder response procedures, school resource officers and training, threat assessments, and program information briefings to school officials and law enforcement. School Safety Center staff are consultants and advisors, but not regulators. So I have a couple testifiers here today that will give you a little bit of background about school safety centers. They do fall under the broad umbrella of the Homeland Security. So I will start with Commissioner Bob Hawkins, okay, and he'll give you some background information. Thank you.
And Representative Christensen, before we do that, you do have an A1 amendment.
I'm sorry. Yes, I do.
And I had forgotten about it as well. This is going to put the bill in the shape that you want it for us to consider as we move through the process.
Okay. Do I have to move it right now?
So, yes, why don't you please move A1?
Okay. So I do move the A1 amendment.
Very well.
Should I describe that amendment? Or?
You certainly can. It's pretty simple.
Okay, yeah. It's very simple. Yeah. We just put a dollar figure in, so we put the $250,000 per year in there.
Very well.
So, okay, thanks.
So with that, members, all in favor of the A1 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign.
Before we conclude the vote about the amendment?
Why don't we come back to your question, because we're okay. In the middle of the vote. And so the motion passes. House File 950 is amended before us in the manner in which the author wishes it to be before us. Representative Dean. Chair Dean.
Mr. Chair and Representative Christensen. So as I look at the bill as it's changed now, the A1 amendment on line 1.4 says, page 1, line 9, after the period inserted, the base appropriation for fiscal 2022 in each fiscal year thereafter is increased by $250,000, and this might be a question for our fiscal analyst. When a bill moves forward, does the base change when we add $250,000 to it? And would that mean then in 2023 it would be the $250,000 plus another $250,000, and every year after that it would continue to increase an additional $250,000. I'm just trying to understand what this bill does, that's all.
Mr. Walz.
Mr. Chair and Representative Dean, the intent of the language is to add $250,000 to the program in perpetuity.
Sure.
I believe that this language does that. It is a little bit confusing. This is something we usually, if it's in an omnibus bill, we will clean up the language with budget riders to make sure that the intent is very specific and that MMB does what it is that we are providing funding for.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Walz, thank you. I'm glad we got this on the record on what we intend to do and how we intend to do it. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Dean. And I was moving a little bit quick here because upon slowing down and thinking about your question, same question popped in my mind. I'm wondering, Representative Christensen, we're going to lay this open for possible inclusion. My suggestion would be that we that you work with fiscal staff in the event that we move this bill into the omnibus bill to have much clearer language here that reflects the author's intent.
Good advice. I'll do that.
Before that time. Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, this brings up a good question, as what Raymond Dean brought up, or Representative Dean. I'm just wondering, any idea when we are going to have our budget books, so when we have these bills come up, that we can actually look back, see what the bases are on some of these programs?
Representative Johnson, we do have the budget books prepared by staff. Tells me that we're going to distribute them later when we go through the corrections budget. It has been the practice of many committees to take those budget books back with them in between. I'm certainly open to advice on how you want to do it. I've also served on committees where I've kept the budget books. I find some advantages to that, to be able to use it as a record, you know, where I write things in. Of course, the issue is that there are times when I forgot my budget book. And so I think I'll probably just leave it to members to figure out how they want to do that, but we will be distributing those later this evening. Thank you. Representative Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To that end, could fiscal staff tell us what the base is that this is going into? What's the base for this biennium?
Mr. Walz.
Mr. Chair, this was a program that had lapsed and I believe was reinstated a few years ago. Off the top of my head, I don't know. I think it's $250,000, but I think the testifiers could better answer that question.
And Representative Christensen, I wonder maybe one of your testifiers.
I do have a page from our budget book, and I know how, Representative Johnson, I know how you all feel about the paper that we've gotten, so I don't carry my budget book around with me everywhere either. But I can read some language from it if that's helpful. Should I do that?
Representative Christensen, why don't you give us that information since the question's been asked?
Pardon me?
Why don't you give us that information since the question is out there?
So the governor's investment in school safety preparedness will help meet the increased demand for the SC services to assist in making Minnesota schools safer. The government recommends a general fund appropriation of $250,000 per year to support two additional staff to provide technical assistance to Minnesota schools.
Mr. Chair.
Professor Miller.
And it's okay if we don't have the number right now. I just want to know what the current base is. That's all.
Absolutely.
If we can find that out at some point, that'd be great. Thank
you. Absolutely. Yeah.
I think we have an answer here. Then we can.
Why don't you have your testifier present himself to the committee and make a stab at that question.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members. For the record, my name is Joe Kelly. I'm the director of the Division of Homeland Security and Emergency Management with the Minnesota Department of Public Safety. The current base budget for the Minnesota School Safety Center is $405,000 per year.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Christensen, why don't you proceed with your testimony?
I believe I'm going to move it over to the testifier here. Thank you.
Very well.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Bob Hawkins. I'm the Assistant Commissioner of the Department of Public Safety, and I thank you for being able to be here today to talk about the School Safety Center program. I'll just give you a little bit of history, Mr. Chair and members, and you were kind of hinting at some of it already, that you're familiar with some of that history. The program actually started back in 2007, and it was a federally granted program, and we had five FTEs at that time. And the monies dried up around the area of 2010, 2011, and the program went away. We initially went to the legislature back then to try to reinstate the program, but we were unsuccessful. But then in 2012, unfortunately, the tragedy at Sandy Hook, the shooting at that elementary school, because of that, the legislature decided to reinstate the program. We asked for 4 FTEs at the time, and we were given 3, and that's what we're currently funded at right now, is 3 FTEs. When the program first started, on average, were making about 1 presentation to 1 contact per week annually. And the staff that we had was more than adequate to cover that. But because of all the tragic experiences, the violence in the schools across the country, the demand in service and that need dramatically increased. And in 2012, when it was reinstated, we were reaching out to approximately 35 K-12 programs with the programming that we provided. And as the programs matured and demand grew, we started to reach out to all schools, the public schools, 336. We added the private schools, 450, charter schools, 164, to a total number of schools we are reaching out to, 954. Right now, those presentations and contacts per week are to the amount of almost 200 annually. And with our 3 FTEs, we just can't keep up with that demand. As one of the things that Representative Christensen mentioned, one of the real strengths of this program is the fact that we are consultants and we're advisors, we're not regulators. We are opened into those schools with open arms. They want us to be a part of what they're trying to do, and that's to make their schools safer. We do things such as facility security assessments, emergency plan reviews, the active school violent intruder response procedures, the school resource officer training. That's the police officers that are in the schools across the state. I actually used to be a school resource officer myself down in Burnsville. We make contacts and briefings with the teachers, the staff, the principals, superintendent, school board members, and law enforcement. Obviously, the governor strongly supports what we're trying to do here with that ask to add 2 additional FTEs to our program, and that's what we're hoping to be able to do.
Very well. Thank you, Assistant Commissioner Hawkins. Representative Christensen?
One more testifier.
Mr. Kelly.
Mr. Chair and members, again, thank you for the opportunity to talk a little bit about this today. The mission, just to declare that clearly, the mission of the School Safety Center is to help Minnesota School provide a safe and secure environment for students, families, teachers, staff, and visitors. We serve Minnesota's K-12 public, private, charter, and tribal schools, and we strive to help them be better prepared to respond to an incident and quickly recover from its effects. As Commissioner Hawkins aptly pointed out, we've gone from basically having 1 mission per week to visiting a school almost every day. If you think about the number of work days there are in a year, it's about 250 or 260, depending on whether or not you take vacation. Last year, the precise number of school visits and presentations for the team was 262. That means that every single working day our staff is out there, and they can't meet the demands of our current customers, much less to get at some of the program development and expansion that we are hearing the schools would like us to provide. Things like the ability to create formal school safety certificate training. In other words, to train administrators and teachers to a specific level for School Safety Center. Developing post-certified school resource officer training and continuing education programs, updating and improving the resource libraries that we have on our website, and creating better products to help the schools with planning and exercising both pre- and post-incident procedures, such as family reunification. So School Safety Center preparedness is important for violent intrusions, as well as what do we do during natural disasters, hazardous materials incidents, a fire, or a technology failure. And the department wants to make sure that we can meet that increased demand that we are hearing from the schools across Minnesota. And to accomplish that, We need those two additional employees that the governor has included in the budget, and as Representative Christensen is suggesting in House File 950. Mr. Chair, that concludes our formal remarks. I do, we're certainly open to questions, and we have a couple of the staff here today to help us answer any questions your committee may have.
Thank you very much, Director Kelly. We do have a question from our lead, Representative Johnson.
Chair Mariani, Assistant Commissioner, you talked about helping the schools doing with their training and things like that. I'm just wondering if you help with the training in the Minneapolis schools and if you include the school resource officers who actually know those schools very well, know the ins and outs, and know the...
Mr. Chair and Representative Johnson, the short answer is yes. We work in the Minneapolis schools, and we do spend time with their school resource officers. So yes is the short answer, sir.
Are there any further questions from committee members? Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify on House File 950? If not, then very well. Thank you, Assistant Commissioner and Director Kelly. And with that, the chair lays, Representative Christensen, any final comments, thoughts?
I'd just like to thank everyone for doing this. I think schools will thank you. I think some of the safety issues that we're taking care of on public safety, I think we need to always recognize what happens has to happen in schools. And I thank you for helping that to make schools safer in Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Christensen. With that, the chair lays House File 950 over for possible inclusion in our committee's divisions on this bill. With that, Chair Considine, I'm wondering if I hadn't wired this up with you, but I note that you have a special guest in the audience with us today. And I think we've heard this guest been referenced to a few times during committee hearings, and so I'm wondering if you would do us the honor of letting us know who you've got visiting with us today.
Thank you, Chair Mariani. My daughter is here, who is a custody officer at the Shakopee Women's Prison, and been my pride and joy.
It's a pleasure to have you here, and thank you for the work that you do at Shakopee. Very well. Representative Wozniak? House File 812. And I'm wondering, Chair Dean, if you could help me, because I want to make sure I get the right motions before us. If you would be so kind as to move House File 812 be laid over for possible inclusion under this bill.
Chair Mariani, yeah, I would move that 812 be laid over for possible inclusion.
Very well. And I'm looking for an amendment, but I don't see one, so I think I might be in good shape here. Thank you. Welcome to the committee, Representative Wozniak. House File 812 is before us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for getting my last name correct. That's not a thing that happens all the time, so I appreciate that.
I grew up in Chicago, so that, that's where that comes from.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So House File 812 is a bill that broadens the definition of position of authority in the criminal sexual conduct statutes. Currently, this applies to an adult who is in a position of authority over a minor, but this bill extends that to include anybody who was recently in a position of authority, and it creates a 120-day kind of look-back period for that role. And this is, I have a testifier here to speak to the bill, but I think one of the things that we know about cases that we hear like this is there's often a grooming period in cases where someone is assaulting a minor. So this bill attempts to address a piece of that. And I have a testifier here to speak to the bill as well.
Very well. Welcome to our committee. Please give us your name and your testimony.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Mariani and members of the committee. My name is Jean Ronain, and I'm appearing today on behalf of the Minnesota Coalition Against Sexual Assault in support of House File 812. My 21 years of prior experience as an advocate for victims of sexual violence, a director of the sexual assault program in Rochester, Minnesota, and former executive director for MnCASA, informs my testimony today. Additionally, I have prior experience in both child protection and in probation fields, which directly intersect with sexual violence as well. The prevailing thread that is the foundation of Minnesota's criminal sexual conduct statutes is that each subdivision speaks to the presence of an imbalance of power. So whether that imbalance of power occurs because of the use of a weapon or superior strength, or from an imbalance of power inherent in a relationship between the persons involved, such as when one person is an adult and another person is a child, as well as in situations where one person is in a position of authority over another. MnCASA developed the language that's included in this bill together with prosecutors from around the state through its public policy committee. And this bill is also supported by the Minnesota County Attorneys Association. The committee who drafted this measure wanted to address two situations where they have been unable to hold school employees responsible for sexual conduct with students, particularly in situations where the student is over the age of 16. So the first situation is where the teacher or the coach engaging in that sexual conduct with the student doesn't directly teach or coach that particular student, but meets or gains access to the student through a school-sponsored event or the school venue. The lack of that adult's direct authority over the student has resulted in the inability at times to address the exploitation in the imbalance of power. The second situation is where the teacher or coach did directly teach or coach the student, but it's summer break, for instance, or the teacher or coach has changed, or the student has changed schools, or that coaching season or period has ended. So the imbalance of power, we recognize that this imbalance of power doesn't abruptly change upon that event. It's a school break or the coaching season has ended. Yet the current statute makes it difficult to charge or convict the teacher or coach in those situations. So as Representative Wozlawick stated, this bill creates that look-back period then for 120 days for the position of authority. A person in a position of authority over a child, again, is someone who is acting in the place of a parent and has a duty to protect the welfare of the child. MnCASA and the members of our public policy committee believe that this change is necessary so that young people are not subject to grooming that might occur through school or extracurricular activities and then engage in sexual conduct when the school year or the extracurricular activity is over. And lastly, this bill also includes language about assuming a position of authority. Sometimes the parent might not have directly empowered or charged someone with responsibility for the child, but that person assumes the role. That could be, for example, when someone assumes the role of a mentor or a tutor of a student without the parent's knowledge or express direction. Thank you for your consideration of House File 812 and my testimony today.
Thank you, Ms. Romaine, for your testimony. Are there any questions for Ms. Romaine? Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I know I'm going to butcher your name, Wozlawick. I want to thank you for bringing this bill forward. For those that were not on the committee last year, our former Vice Chair, Representative Lomar, carried this bill, and the committee did such good work that this is the exact same bill, word for word, and it's a good bill, and I want to thank you for bringing it.
Very well. Are there any further questions? Anyone else, or is there anyone in the audience that wishes to testify for or against House File 812? All right, very well. Representative Wozlawick, you get the final word then.
I don't really have much to say, but I hope that you will support the bill. It's a good bill, and it's been through a lot of work, and I think this is the time to pass it and get it done.
It does seem to me, Representative Wasilewicz and Ms. Romaine, that, and it's interesting because I've had these conversations with Representative O'Neill in the past few weeks, that part of what I see happening with public policy is that we're emerging it as we're learning about the intricacies of certain behaviors in action. So, you know, a decade ago, I think most Americans would not know necessarily what the word grooming means. That became part of I would argue, common lexicon, particularly stemming from the Penn State incident or incidences. You know, a few years ago. And so I think it's absolutely appropriate that both sides here are attempting to emerge our policy to evolve with the deep knowledge about behavior that is harming and victimizing people. So with that, then Representative Wasilewicz, Representative Dean, well, actually the chair moves then to lay over House File 812 for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill. Thank you for the bill. Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
Representative Grossel, House File 89. Representative Grossel, I believe your motion would then be to lay over House File 89 for possible inclusion in this division's omnibus bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. House File 89, you heard last year, and it is the bill that increases the penalties on child pornography. It requires a mandatory minimum sentence for first offense and second offense of 1 or 6 months the first round and a year on the second offense. Like I said, it also increases the overall penalty and increases the probation for the offenders who commit these crimes. Today, members, you're going to, I want to give fair warning that today you're going to hear some very heart-wrenching stories. You're going to hear some very detailed and very painful situations, descriptions of cases, descriptions of what child pornography really is. So I want you to be prepared for that. It is going to enrage you. It is going to bring you to tears. It is going to make you outright disgusted and appalled. So with that being said, I will turn testimony over to Detective Heather Holden of the Bemidji Police Department.
Thank you.
Welcome to the committee, Detective Holden. And welcome to, and I just want to acknowledge, I believe you did the drive down this morning.
I did, yes.
So I just want to acknowledge that. I suppose it could have been worse. You could have been driving from somewhere south.
yes.
But welcome to the committee, and please proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Heather Holden. I'm a detective with the City of Bemidji. I'm also a member of the Minnesota Internet Crimes Against Children Task Force and a member of the Minnesota Human Trafficking Task Force through the BCA. I'm also a certified computer forensic examiner. So along with the cyber investigations that I do, I examine the computers of the individuals that we find in possession of child pornography. I have been with the Bemidji Police Department in this role since 2014. And in that time frame, I would estimate I have looked at over 500,000 images of child pornography. Child pornography is not a victimless crime. Child pornography is the sexual assault of a child. Every one of those images is the rape of a child. Those images are often used to groom children because 50 to 80% of people that possess those images are contact offenders. They use those images to show children that there's nothing wrong with the things that they're going to do. Child pornography is a ladder, possession. We start out with the teens, and you progress once you've lost sexual gratification and looking at images of teens in sexual positions. Then you de-escalate, you don't de-escalate. You go down that ladder, and you go to preteens. And from there, you go to elementary, and then you go to toddler. And at that next offense is going to be a contact offense on their victim. I have worked some of the most horrific cases I have ever seen in my life. One of those would be the example of Jacob Kinn. Jacob Kinn was convicted in 2013 of child possession, child pornography possession. He, because this was his first offense, received a stay of adjudication for 5 years. 2016, Jacob Kinn murdered Melissa Norby. He kidnapped a 5-year-old girl. He also committed arson and burned down Melissa's home with her body in it. He kidnapped a 5-year-old girl, who I'm going to call Jessica. That's not her name, but we're going to refer to her as Jessica. He took that little girl, and he sexually assaulted her, brought her from Bemidji, approximately 80 miles away to the north, and left her in the middle of 80 acres in a camper, duct taped, and left her alone there. He then came back to Bemidji, and we were lucky enough, by the grace of God and great detective work with my team, that we found him, and excellent police work led to the recovery of Jessica. Jessica was found by two BCA agents bound with duct tape in a camper that goes above the cab. And mind you, she was 5 years old at the time and could not get down from the area where she was left. Through our investigative work after finding Jessica and bringing Jacob to justice, we found that he and the individual who he had murdered began sexually assaulting Jessica in about 2014, while he was still on probation, while he was not to have access to the internet. Jacob created pornography of these sexual assaults, and he traded that pornography throughout the internet. That little girl that was saved by those investigators will forever have those images out there. Those images do not go away. Child pornography is not a victimless crime. It is also not something that is just associated with child pornography. Exploitation occurs all the time by sending. I also am a undercover chatter for the Internet Crimes Against Children, so I pretend to be a 14 or a 15-year-old. And I have these individuals send me images saying, I want to do this to you, and this is what I want to do with you. And it's child pornography. That's their grooming behavior. I've also worked with the investigators from the Beltrami County Sheriff's Office who pushed for a case of an assistant principal of the Bemidji Middle School who was pretending to be another child and using Snapchat. And he was targeting girls that he had contact with every day in that middle school through Snapchat and asking them to send explicit pictures. And he had multiple victims. And these girls sent pictures, and again, those images are out there forever. And I've talked to those investigators, and the reason that they pushed for federal prosecution was so that this principal would be sitting time and he would not be able to victimize any more children. Because had we went by the sentencing guidelines for Minnesota, he would have had the same as Jacob Kinn. He wouldn't have spent any time in jail. He would have had probation. With the federal guidelines, he is now sitting for 90% of his time of his 15-year sentence. Just recently, I've started a federal case for an individual who was indicted in February, who had the most horrific child pornography I've seen, and I've seen a lot of it, unfortunately. But the first thing that I saw was a video from HSI, that's Homeland Security Investigation, who the Royal Canadian Mounted Police had sent to them, and it's a video of a 5-year-old girl being raped and crying for her mother through the entire rape. This individual, when I went through his computer, had images of a child still in a footed sleeper with full penetration. He had pictures of children 5 years old and younger being forced fellatio. He sent those pictures out to just random people and random children that he found on Facebook. He knew that they were children. These children would say, "I'm 10 years old, what are you doing?" And he would say, "It's okay. It stretches like elastic. They enjoy it once it starts." This is the grooming behavior that people that possess child pornography do. This individual also stalked a little girl who was in his target range. As investigators, we have target ranges, and we know after looking through these images what his target range was. His target range was 5 to 6 years old. That's what a majority of his images were. The little girl that he stalked, he had access to until her mother said, "This is not right," and she got a protection order and moved away from him. He still actively stalked her. And I can tell you that I pushed for that case to go federal, for federal prosecution, because he had no criminal history. And I knew that he would not stop. So I pushed for it to go federal so that that little girl was safe. And the numerous other little children that he was sending these images out to. He would also send images to mothers, single mothers. His search history was single mothers over the age of 40. And so he would start talking to these individuals on Kick and Plenty of Fish. And he would start sending images out and saying, "This is what, can you pose your daughter this way for me?" He pretended to be a photographer and saying that, "I would like to take pictures of your daughter. Can you please bring her to the studio?" And he would talk about a special fee for the special studio of paying these mothers. And he targeted mothers that were in hard situations because of money. And I am just thankful that we got to him before we believe he was able to offend on any of those children. These are the things that I see in all of the internet investigations that I do. It's not teenagers sexting with each other and sending images back and forth. These are 40, 30-year-old men looking for images of toddlers and children that they can violate in terrible and horrific ways, sadomasochistic ways. It's not anything that is acceptable in society. And that's why I support the bill and the better sentencing guidelines. Thank you.
Thank you, Detective Holden. Are there, Representative Grassley?
Go ahead, sir.
Very well. I was just going to ask if you had any other testifiers and then also open up to the broader floor before we got into some questions. All right, so no further testifiers. Is there anyone in the audience that wishes to testify On House File 89. All right, very well. So then we are open for questions at this point. Oh, Mr. Mueller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Detective Holden, for the work that you do. I don't frankly know how you do it. I'm a prosecutor, and I have handled a couple of these cases, and I'm only glad I've had a couple, because you have to look at those images, and they're horrific and terrible. My question is more geared towards Representative Grossel. You and I have talked about this bill on a number of occasions. I do support increased penalties in these cases, but I'm a little concerned about how we're going about doing it in this case, so I wanted to ask you about a couple of the provisions. If you take a look at line 2.26, it's the mandatory minimum sentence, and so my understanding of this is a mandatory probationary term. So most of these offenses, many of them are presumptive stayed sentences, which I think is unfortunate for a number of reasons. But this, to me, is getting at a mandatory term of incarceration at a probationary period. And so I had asked House Research to look in, because I've never seen something like that before, and I was just a little concerned about putting something like that into statute. And I forwarded you the results of that. So I'm just kind of curious about why you want to have that mandatory jail term instead of trying to just increase or get rid of the stayed sentences just at the felony level.
Representative Grossel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative. What with the mandatory minimums, because, of course, as you stated, that unless they have multiple criminal history points, these sentences are presumed stays all the way across. There have been multiple cases that our detective just described. The Jacob Wetterling abductor and murderer, same type of scenario, was not going to cooperate until he got hit with federal charges. Okay? So to prevent these predators from flying under the radar, as was described, they got either a stay of imposition or they got a stay of adjudication. A stay of adjudication allows them to fly under the radar, stay out there in public, and continue to stalk and continue to hurt children. These are not, they may have just been caught for the first time, but they have been victimizing other children. You can bet on it. So it was to the mandatory minimums was to get these people off of the street, because they should not be out there. These are cases where these people should not be out in public.
Representative Baldwin.
Yeah, and I appreciate that. I just am still not clear about why the probationary sentence instead of trying to get rid of the stayed sentences at the felony level. And maybe Mr. Diebel can just explain like what we had emailed about whether or not other statutes provide for mandatory jail terms at a probationary level.
Mr. Diebel.
Mr. Chair and members, I'm not aware of any other statutes that provide for this sentencing option.
Thank you. And then kind of something similar to that is page 4. The sentencing guidelines modification starting at line 12. And again, this is something I had indicated. I have a little bit of concern about specifically telling the guidelines where on the grid these offenses should be, not because I think you're wrong about where they should be on the grid, but because I haven't seen this in statute either, and I'm afraid that every time a statute changes, we're going to be then telling the sentencing guidelines where on the grid for every crime things should be. And it's not something I necessarily want to have in statute. And so I just wanted to get your thoughts on leaving that in there as well.
As you've heard again, and as was described, thank you, Mr. Chair, as was described, Representative, these horacious crimes, these horrible pictures, these horrible scenes, the victimization of these children, to push them up the sentencing grid, the guidelines, would be to bring them closer to a presumptive prison sentence and to bring this crime, it's not just pictures, it is actually these sexual assaults of these children as well, is to bring this crime more in line with other crimsex crimes.
Representative Mulder.
Yeah, Representative Grossel, and I appreciate that. And again, I tend to agree with you about that. It's just I'm concerned about instructing the guidelines exactly where to put things on the grid. And I'm just curious if we go with the increasing the penalty from 10 to 15 years, which I am in favor of, would that make the guidelines look at changing the grids to reflect what it is that you want to do without having to put those exact things into the statute? And again, I'm wondering if either you can answer that or maybe Mr. Diebel would be willing to answer that question.
Representative Grassel, we do have someone from the Sentencing Guidelines here too, so you might be able to direct your questions that way. But Mr. Diebel.
Mr. Chair and members, first of all, I need to amend my prior answer. Our DWI expert pointed out that there is a mandatory jail sentence in the DWI provisions. So Mr. Johnson brought that to my attention. So it's apparently is not novel, but within the 609 series, I'm not aware of it. But the executive director, I think, should reply to what their response would be to a directive from the legislature to in the manner that Representative Grossel has proposed and how they typically handle a statutory max increase.
I agree. I think that would be appropriate. I'm wondering if our director from Sentencing Guidelines can come forward and field Representative Mueller's second question then.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I think there's a...
And I'm sorry, you'll need to state your name for the record, sir.
My name is Nathaniel Wrights. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines Commission. I think in 609.582, there's a 6 month for certain first-degree burglaries, and in 609.11, I think there's a 1 year for certain offenses committed with a dangerous weapon other than a firearm. With respect to the re-ranking requirement, I don't know what to say at this point, Mr. Chair, because the commission does not have it before it. The commission is currently looking at its work plan for the upcoming year or 2 year period, and it is aware of the fact that the 90th Minnesota legislature enacted a provision that would basically this provision that's in Representative Grossel's bill that asked the Sentencing Guidelines Commission to look at re-ranking offenses, and although that did not ultimately become enacted in law, it was passed by both the House and the Senate, and that's certainly something that the Commission considers it as a directive from the legislature, if not a law. The one of the factors that the Commission considers is the statutory maximum penalty, and to the way the sentencing guidelines are structured, the maximum penalty depends on the criminal history of the offender, and as the testifier pointed out, some of these offenders have had no criminal history, which under current guidelines philosophy gives that offender the more lenient sentences. And some of these offenses do not have very high statutory maximums, which means typically that the general way that the guidelines have historically been structured is to max out on the far right of the grid, that is to say with the offenders who have the highest criminal histories. So there's a limitation there when some of these offenses don't have very high criminal histories. With respect to how high the offense can be ranked. Having said that, I don't want to make it seem as though the commission has made a determination on this recently. They have ranked these offenses, and they're always looking to improve the sentencing guidelines. One other thing I would just add in terms of interplay between statutes and the sentencing guidelines is typically the commission, I think almost universally, the commission does not put in distinctions that do not exist in the statute itself. So, for example, if there are aggravating factors that would make one offender, an offender who ought to go to prison more than another offender, it is eminently appropriate to put that into statute. And then the commission then has some freedom to rank that offense differently than, say, maybe a more typical offender, unlike the offenders that have been testified about, who's possessing the child pornography for his own gratification rather than sharing it with others. That last comment was strictly made based on my own experience as a former prosecutor and not a reflection on the opinion of the Sentencing Guidelines Commission. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Director Rice. Representative Mullen.
Yeah, thank you. So if I heard you right, if we're increasing the statutory maximum in statute, that is something the guidelines would consider then when looking at the grid and ranking these offenses. That was part of what I heard.
Commissioner Rice.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mueller, that's correct. That one, it's a cue from the legislature to the commission as to how serious the legislature thinks the offense is. And two is it gives a little higher of a ceiling for the commission to work with in terms of ranking it in a way that fits the geometry of the grid, if you will.
And one final one.
No issue. We have time today, Representative Mueller.
Thank you. And then the other piece you mentioned was aggravating factors. And Representative Grossel, you and I actually had a brief discussion about that, too, possibly looking at maybe number of images, because I know a lot of these offenders don't just have one picture. I see detectives smiling and agreeing with that. And so, you know, potentially maybe that's something that could be used as an aggravating factor, based on number of images or something to that effect. I don't know if you had a comment on, maybe that was more of a comment, less of a question.
Senator Gross.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I took that as more of a comment
than
a question,
yep.
but thank you for the questions.
Perhaps something to consider in terms of continuing to construct legislation here. Are you done, Representative?
I am, thank you.
Very well. Representative Johnson?
Mr. Chair, this question's probably for the detective. Years ago, when I was on the force, our ICAC officer would be working some of these cases. And one of the issues, I don't know if it's been taken care of or not, maybe you can enlighten the committee, is that when they'd find these images, they had a tough time with some of the prosecutions because they could not identify the victim. Is that changed, or you still need to try to identify the victim in these cases with the images?
We do try to identify the victim, and we use the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children for that identification. These images have a unique signature. It's called a hash, and we send those through to NCMEC. But in the case where it's easily with these last cases that I've worked where the children are 5 years old and younger, there's no way that could not be a child, and I will testify to that in court. So.
Representative Johnson, please.
Mr. Chair, but if you can identify these victims, it makes the case much easier to go through court.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair.
Representative Grossel.
If you could just, if you'd be so kind as to keep the laughing and joking down,
yeah,
please.
That's a request for the audience to just keep down the chatter a bit so that we can fully hear the questions. Representative Johnson, I think you were done with your question. Right? And that was of Detective Holden, a detective.
We do. It does make the prosecution, if they are victims, actual victims, more strong, I believe. But lots of times we aren't able to identify the children. We do try to identify everyone just so that we can find other victims of sexual assault and offer them the services that they need after those incidences. Also, when those identified images are presented, they are each one of those victims is notified that their images are still out there and they have the option of restitution.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Grossel, thank you for your work on this. And I guess I'm building on Representative Moeller's points that I certainly agree that we need to take this extremely seriously. And, and the detective, we've had a little bit of a chance, I think, to work together, Detective, through the years on some of these issues. I guess I do have the concern. I'm just stepping back and thinking about the directive to the guidelines, some of the other points here that, you know, if we think about our whole scheme of how we set up our criminal laws, we say that certain conduct is so reprehensible that we're going to criminalize it, and then we're going to set based on the we're going to set a fine and a number of years based on the concern that we have. And then the guidelines commission then, as was said by the commissioner, then looks at how we've set it and then goes from there. So I think one of the reasons that I have concerns about directing the guidelines commission to set at a certain severity level is that I sort of feel like, well, then at that point, if we have that concern, what we want to do is set the years and the fine to reflect the severity level that we want the commission to get to and then go from there. And I guess that leads me then to the point about having a minimum number of months, et cetera. Because, I mean, I look at this and I say, this is reprehensible behavior, and part of the consequence is that somebody should be incapacitated for a period of time, both because of what they might do, but also as a social sanction, right? It's saying that this is behavior that is intolerable, such that we want to take away your freedom right away. But that's when I say, well, but then, you know, 6 months, then they get out in the seventh month, right? That I start feeling like when we start doing those shorter period, a mandatory minimum at that point, what I say is, listen, we want to start treating this offense, or make sure that we're treating these offenses as seriously as they are. So I guess this is all looping around Representative Grossel to my appreciating your expanding this. I guess I feel like I need to understand a little more about how this would work, and maybe this leads to a particular question, which is a question you've asked me a number of times. Stakeholders such as county attorneys, Coalition Against Sexual Assault, what is their feeling about your bill as proposed?
Representative Grossel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As to their stance, both of them are standing neutral. Am I correct on that? No. So right now, Mincasa last year stood in support of it. This year, with their changeover, they're standing neutral. So you go figure. But I would be glad to increase the mandatory minimums if you would help me with that. That's just to take it to a level that would be more suitable for these crimes, because in talking with the Minnesota BCA, more and more, they're seeing more and more infant and toddler rape, and more are these torture type videos and
Representative Pinto.
Mr. Chair.
So what I'm saying, I'm sorry.
That's quite all right, Representative.
I'm sorry.
You've lived an existence along with Detective Holden that a number of us have not. And so I want to make sure that we're listening to your perspective and your wisdom, as well as being sensitive to how that's impacted you as a human being. So, but you can certainly continue.
These children need to be represented and they need to be protected. And to me, this was, the best way that I could think of. Get them off the street.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I get that. That leads to a point that I wanted to end with anyway, which is, you know, we have a lot of. So, I've handled a number of these cases. At this point, I'm doing so in the charging area. So, I'm simply describing what a detective has written in a report, describing what's happening in a video, and then I'm describing what that detective has described to me. And I find it disturbing just to type out the words describing, and you have to, you know, describe 5 or 10 photos or videos and exactly what's happening. And we have a lot of heroes in public service and a lot of heroes in law enforcement, but the individuals doing the work that the detective is, that I gather Representative Grossel did, of actually working through this work, working through those, seeing the photos, seeing the videos, that is incredibly heroic work.
That yes, as you're referencing, Mr. Chair, I don't know that I would have the stomach for that. Again, I hardly have the stomach to type it out to describe what's being put forward. So I guess Representative Grossel, for you and your past work, but Detective, for you and your work and for your colleagues, just know how grateful we all are to you for protecting children in that way. That is incredibly tough work, incredibly tough, and it's so important that you all are doing it, and we all are really grateful to you for doing it. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative.
Thank you, Representative.
I never had to work in that field, but I've had to help investigators who do. So this one over here is my hero.
Very well. Representative Edelson?
I want to thank the detective for your work. And Representative Grossel, this is such a tough topic. As a therapist, I've worked with so many kids that have experienced sexual assault. And as a mom of a six-year-old little boy and 2 9-year-old little boys, the image of Jessica being by herself is heartbreaking. So I just want to thank you for this. I think the intent of your bill is really good, and obviously we want to make sure that our communities are safe. So thank you, Representative Grossel, for bringing this bill.
Representative Grossel, I have a question, and perhaps there might be others that can help us with it. It seems to me, and this is not my field, I do not practice law or law enforcement, but it seems to me that part of the reason why there would be stays for a first-time offense, a minimum required jail sentence, I suspect has to do with the ability to get a conviction, the ability to get the eye of our correction system, our law enforcement system, squarely on an individual that perhaps the evidence just isn't there, as horrific as the accusations might be. It seems to me that something like that is, in an imperfect world, better than not being able to keep an eye on someone. So I'm just wondering, perhaps, Detective, you can comment on this as well. I understand what we're wrestling with in terms of what's the appropriate level of response. But I do know that sometimes it's just hard to get a conviction. But short of that, you can get something else that provides some level of scrutiny, oversight, some level of accountability, et cetera. So I'm wondering if you can comment on that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll defer to Detective Holden here.
Detective.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I can tell you from my own experience, in the first case that I ever worked with, this was a gentleman who had close to 800 images. And had he not had any criminal history, he would have still received, even with that amount of images, he would have still received the stay of imposition or adjudication. We have the images. It depends on their criminal history points. And I can't charge them with 800 images because it's not going to make a difference in how long. But the maximum that my county attorneys say is 6 images, and that's the amount of charges that they're going to do, whether I have 800 to 1,000. And that's different in the federal system also, and another reason that I push for federal. We have the evidence. It just depends on their criminal history points.
That's helpful, Detective. Thank you. Representative Nash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Detective Holden, thank you for a horrible job that you do protecting Minnesota kids. As a father of 6, you don't ever want to think about your kids, and I'm very protective of my children. And just the thought of this drives me to distraction. Thank you for stepping up and standing up. And members, this is where we can show that we can do One Minnesota together. We can all pass a law that will try to protect these kids. I think of my daughters and my sons who at your target age, you said was 5 and 6 years old. The biggest concern on their mind is what's for dinner and I don't ever want to have kids not have to focus on just something that innocent. So thank you very much for doing just a job that I couldn't do. I would seek a different form of justice, I think, if I was faced in your shoes. But I appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Ash. Representative Mueller. Oh, I'm sorry, Miller.
Miller.
Well, Mr. Chair,
it's the second time this year.
That's right.
Representative Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my questions have been answered, but my statement, I think, needs to be said for the sake of determining what we do in this committee. I have some notes. Representative Grassl, first of all, thank you. Since you've been in office, you've been championing some form of basically saying we need to address these things better and with stiffer penalties. People need to be held accountable for these things. Mr. Chair and committee, I'm not an attorney, but I am a husband, and I can tell you that some people know my wife's story, but it applies directly to this. Not everyone knows it. For the first 13 years of her life, she was sexually molested by her stepfather, including getting her pregnant. And I can tell you that when it finally came to light, this was many years ago, he was given a 90-day work release sentence. And a year later, after she left, foster care went back home. He was there again, and he tried it again. He served no more time. Now, that was 1982, and we can say certainly we've done better since then. As I've talked to Representative Grassl over the last several years, we haven't done any better. We haven't done any better on this stuff, and he's talking something specific about photos and stuff like that today. I can tell you the work I've done on trafficking of children, same thing. Sexual molestation, same thing. We can go on and on and on. And what I would say is this is a challenge to my attorneys who have been prosecutors in this committee. If what Representative Grassl is doing here isn't doing the trick to get these people off the streets, then please help us. Because the problem is that we have these discussions and we talk about sentencing guidelines and stuff like that, and it's been 4 years, right? 4 years, and we haven't come up with a solution. Again, I'm not an attorney, but I can tell you the far vast population of the state of Minnesota are not attorneys, and they want to know why these creeps are on the street. That's just what they want. They want them gone. And I don't disagree with that at all. And we can talk about how this affects that person when they get out or what it does to this and does to that, but the fundamental thing is we have a growing problem in the United States. It's not getting less. It's growing. Of things related to pornography, child molestation. Earlier today we were talking about, Detective, you're talking about this, about how, and in trafficking we've learned this, it starts off at 17 years old, then 15, then 12. And the average age for a child that's initially been trafficked is 12 years old now. So all these different topics. So I guess I would challenge us that if this doesn't work, there's got to be a way. We're the legislature. There's a way that we can make this work. So I want to thank you for this bill, and I hope that by the end of the session, we finally get this figured out. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Miller. I humbly accept your sharing with us today as well. Thank you. With that, no, it's not Miller. We forgot to scratch Miller off there. So, very well. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on this bill? Representative Russell, you get the last word.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. These children are crying out for your help. The one that I described was crying for a mother. Our detectives, investigators, the BCA special agents are asking for your help. I'm asking. Let's get something done on this. Let's get something done worthwhile.
Very well. Thank you, Representative Grassl. Detective Holden, thank you. You've heard a number of us express our appreciation for the difficult work that you do. Thank you for doing it. With that, members, let me make sure I have the right number. The chair will lay House File 89 over for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill. And members, I do want to share. Oh, wait a minute. We have one other item, but I do want to share, in light of this heartfelt, very difficult conversation that we will be hearing a number of bills throughout this week related to youth and public safety, bills related to juvenile corrections and ways to provide alternatives for youth. I believe it's all within the spirit of making sure that we're doing our best to protect our young people. And so protecting them from horrible acts of crime, but also protecting them from systemic responses involving their behaviors as well, which aren't always perhaps as helpful for them in their own development. So there's, in my mind, there's a well-rounded approach in terms of how we walk with our young people in the state of Minnesota and provide protection and safety for them. We do have action on one more bill today. And we will be hearing on that note from the Minnesota Youth Council tomorrow. And tomorrow's 12:45 hearing. The Minnesota Youth Council is a creature of the legislature. We created them several years ago as a way to collect the voices in a very structured way of young people from all across the state so that they can both study public policy, but quite frankly, so that they can inform us as we develop laws that impact them and the broader society. Members, we do have, we heard House File 50, Representative Hornstein's cell phone use bill, the so-called hands-free bill. We're going to get better at this, or the chair promises to get better, but we had the wrong motion, technically. Our motion, when we acted, was to re-refer House File 50 to Ways and Means. In fact, instead, our motion formally was to refer to Judiciary, which is where, of course, Ways and Means will send it, but it was not our motion. It was not the correct motion for us to make. Rather was to send it back to Ways and Means. So with that, I'm wondering, Chair Considine, if you would move to reconsider the motion to pass House File 50, which was amended, to Judiciary.
So moved, Chairman.
Thank you. So members will move on that motion to reconsider. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. And then, Representative Constant, I wonder if you would be so kind as to then move to re-refer House File 50 to the Ways and Means Committee.
So moved, Chairman.
Thank you, Chair Constant. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you. So, members, Yes, that's right. So we are going to get back together later today, but it's going to be with the Subcommittee on Corrections to have a walkthrough, hopefully not terribly long, of the corrections budget. So we won't be recessing. I think the proper motion is for us to adjourn and then reconvene later, and that's going to be at 5 p.m. And we're meeting back in this room. So members, be aware that we will then convene that committee in joint session with our Subcommittee of Corrections later on. And with that, members, this committee stands for this hearing. And today's hearing is really quite simple. It's to have a walkthrough of the governor's corrections budget. And we're joined today by officials from the Corrections Department to walk us through that. There's a PowerPoint that we'll be referencing that should be also copied at each of the members' desks, and we have distributed the budget books as well. Members, I would ask that you let my LA, Jason, know whether or not you want to take your book with you. I'm okay with that. I know oftentimes members prefer to just read it at their own comfort and mark it up, et cetera. My only caution is make sure you bring it to the meetings because, you know, you'll be able to reference it later on as we start, marking up the appropriations parts of our omnibus bill. You're certainly free to leave them here, and committee staff will I'll make sure that we'll shuttle them back and forth between meetings. So with that, Chair Constant, I'm going to turn to you and have you lead us in the presentation of the corrections budget.
Thank you, Chair Mariani. Commissioner Stell, would you like to begin?
Thank you, Chairs and committee member. It's an honor to be able to present the governor's budget tonight on corrections. I also want to just make sure that I speak to the fact that we're really appreciative of the time and attention the committee has given to corrections in general over the past several weeks. It's much appreciated, and I think it's helpful. Brings, I think, incredible attention to the hard work that corrections does, and is much appreciated. You are given two packets tonight. One is it provides the budget overview. This is the governor's budget. These were the additions in requests that are being made. And the second one is a supplementary PowerPoint. And that supplementary document really provides background information on the distribution of our budget that may be useful and maybe something that we can refer to as we take questions. With me tonight is Chris Dodge, who is the Chief Financial Officer, and I will readily defer to him when it comes to the finer points of the numbers. In addition, we have a whole myriad of Department of Corrections staff here to be able to answer most any question that members may have. With that, I just would like to say that as we presented the budget, I made this request to the governor and had conversations with the governor about the budget that we're going to present to you tonight. We wanted a budget that really reflected the whole of the Department of Corrections. Oftentimes, as you all know, that we can think about corrections or think about any form of government by virtue of its units or its function. In our case, we are typically divided in two areas, one being the facilities or the prison side, the other being field services. Ultimately, as we began to think about our budget and what the budget reflected, we felt that it was really important that we work across the divisions, recognize the importance of each of their respective work, and at the same time, understand that the two are inextricably linked in many respects. And that is what I believe this budget reflects. This budget reflects, I think, ultimately what is a focus on our mission. And we've talked about this as the reduction of recidivism, the promotion of offender change, the use of proven strategies, and ultimately that affects the public safety through effective community supervision. With that, I'm going to turn it over to Mr. Dodge to talk a little bit about the distribution of the budget.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Chris Dodge, and I am the Chief Financial Officer for the Department of Corrections. We just have a couple of overview slides on our budget. Our fiscal year 19 budget is $588.139 million. It represents about 2.5% of the governor's total general fund budget, and 96% of our operating budget comes from the general fund. So we have very limited other funds available. 13% of our budget is pass-through money that goes directly to our county partners, and the other 87% is direct services for the department. We do have three divisions or programs in our agency. The largest in terms of dollars and FTEs is the Correctional Institutions Division, 73.3% of our budget. Community services, 22% of our budget, and operations support, which is all of the support functions, including human resources, finance, policy and legal, planning and performance, and others, represents only less than 5% of our overall budget, general fund budget.
The budget request really is focused on a variety of 10 key areas, and we're going to have a moment to kind of talk about each of these and their importance, At the end, the total amount of this of the funding request is approximately $111 million. And I'm going to walk us through each of these areas, so we'll go into them in a bit more detail and can answer questions that members may have. First and foremost was the need for an operating adjustment, and this becomes somewhat of a question that many people oftentimes ask. This really becomes, how do we fund the base budget of the Department of Corrections? In other words, how do we fund things like step increases or the state's portion of health insurance costs or the state's portion of pension costs that get passed along or federal tax obligations? Because of the way the budget is done, these funds are not projected into the future. And so each biennium, we need to come back with a request to address and cover the costs associated with our current operations. And as you can see, it is in 20, it is 10.5 million, and in 21, it is $17.7 million. This, as I said, is simply to keep our budget operational. And if we did not have this funding, this is the equivalent of upwards of 300 FTEs. This funding is what this funding represents. And so I think it does become important that people just understand that this is not something that the department caused to happen. It is something that is just a part of being an employer and having the obligations that we have, either by contract, by law, or by the costs associated with being an employer. One of the key areas, the large areas that is in this budget, is really prison security and safety. And this has been one of the areas that has received considerable attention. And this is broken into kind of three broad areas: staffing, some security infrastructure and technology modernization, and then, of course, the restrictive housing program or segregation, which has received a considerable amount of attention. This is a total request of about $44 million over the biennium, and we'll talk about what this looks like. Ultimately, when we talked about this, we wanted to focus on a staffing analysis that really looks at the way in which we do our business across all of the operational divisions. And operational divisions meaning the prison side as well as the field side. We want to make sure that we're creating safer, more secure prison environments for both our staff and for the inmates that we house. We want to make sure that we increase the safety of our community by ensuring that the quality of programming that we offer meets the needs of those people who are going to be coming back to our community. And as we've talked about in this community before, 95% of those in our correctional facilities will be coming back to communities across our state. This request also includes increases for staffing of operations and programming, including the addition of 120 correctional officers over the biennium. Another core element was the look at technology and prison and technology modernization. We know that in our facilities, and many of you had the opportunity to see some of this in action, our facilities really operate with the use of technology, incredible investments in cameras that allow us to monitor certain areas of the facility, which keeps our officers as well as those who live in our facilities safer. We have over 5,000 workstations throughout the Department of Corrections and 400 servers. We connect to a variety of state and federal criminal justice information systems. And obviously, one of the key things that has come up in the committee before is our need to be able to provide you as policymakers with key information so that you can make good decisions around how you fund us and hold us accountable to the work that we need to accomplish on behalf of Minnesota. This is an investment So in one-time investment in replacement and updating of security systems, cameras, cell door controls, and perimeter protection. In addition, it updates obsolete security systems and addresses those issues where data privacy could be compromised. We also, in this area, focus on the fact that we want to engage in evidence-based practices. The need for that, that has been an area
Commissioner Snell?
Yes.
Chair Mariani has a question.
Thank you, Chair Considine. I just, I guess the first question is of you. Is, would you prefer that we ask questions as we go along in the budget or wait to the entire presentation?
If you're asking my preference, I would say that we do it at the end of each unit.
I defer to the chairs in terms of how you'd like to manage that.
Mr. Chair, my question goes back to the prison security and safety staffing. So maybe that's the end of one unit because you're in infrastructure now. And I know that earlier this morning in the corrections subcommittee, there was a conversation relative to the bill that you authored about the correctional officers, but I know that members of this committee who are not on that have not had the benefit of that conversation. And that could be a long one, but really basically my question is just a short one. If the commissioner can tell us, you know, what is the relationship of the 120 correctional officers in the governor's bill relative to the, I don't know if it's 80 or I think it's right, officers that that the department has had the direction of the appropriations to fill. Is that 80 within this 120, or is that a separate number? So it's really to that issue.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is an addition. At present, we have, again, this is a moving target. We just had an academy start in the past week. But, you know, we talked about 80, having 80 current vacancies, 80 to 90 current vacancies, that those positions remain unfilled or we're in the process of working to fill them. This would be on top of that. So if we take 80, we're really talking about between now and the end of the biennium, the next biennium, we're talking about the need to hire 200 additional correctional officers. So this, on the when we think about prison safety and security from the standpoint of restrictive housing, this has been an area of considerable attention. Representative Zerwas has had a lot of interest, and we'll be talking more about this, I believe, with a bill that's going to be coming up, I think, tomorrow. But we really are focusing on, you know, as we look to better make our facilities safer, we need to make sure that we're investing heavily in evidence-based practices that we know, based on what the evidence and what the data tells us, can reduce recidivism and address offender misconduct. The budget proposal includes the ability for us to maximize this by increasing caseworkers, by increasing behavioral health staff, by providing more cognitive skills therapy and mental health counseling at multiple facilities, especially those facilities that provide and carry out restrictive housing measures throughout the system. Offender health care has been an area of considerable interest and no doubt considerable cost. This, I believe last session there was a bill that did not, was included, but ultimately did not become law. What this request does is it addresses the critical need for us to fulfill our contractual obligations for offender health care. It expands nursing care in our facilities to provide 24/7 nursing care in three more of our facilities, and meets the both federal and state requirement that we have an electronic health record system. I would just point out that the photograph there is an actual photograph of the way that our records are today stored. And this creates significant challenges for, you know, for our medical personnel, especially when offenders leave our facilities and go to either into, for instance, a halfway house, and there may be some type of medical issue, and the ability to access these records, while it can be done, it's not done efficiently, and it's not done in accordance with both state and federal mandates. This budget request would address that by providing broadening our access to an electronic health record system through our current medical provider. We spend right now, we spend right now nearly $90 million a year on healthcare services to people in our corrections facilities. So this is really an incredible number, and I think reflects the broad range of needs of those that are in our facilities, both on the mental health as well as medical fronts. Integrated case management is also a proven and an evidence-based approach. This ultimately reduces the number of people on caseloads. It focuses on positive behavioral approaches and addressing criminogenic thinking. It is ultimately proven to reduce recidivism in a significant way. And particularly, this resource is applied to those offenders who are deemed as being highest risk and having the highest levels of need. We also focus, and we know, and the research has told us, that these cognitive skills-based interventions with this population becomes critically important. I like to describe this as this integrated case management is almost intensive case management, and it provides for what I believe should be a warm handoff between of the offender between when they are in prison and going into reentry services, going out into the field, and I think there was a time when because of the way we were able to manage, which a much smaller population, where field agents and case managers in the facility were able to manage that handoff in a very kind of human way. Where they had talked and had worked and collaborated together around that that offender, and I think what an integrated case management would do is would allow us to have that that happen again, in particular for those inmates, those offenders, where that need is greatest. Pretrial assessment and supervision. Right now in Minnesota, about 25% of Minnesota counties have pretrial assessment and supervision, mostly on a small scale. A recent policy change by the judicial branch to reduce disparities in pretrial detention for those oftentimes who cannot make bail. This was a requirement that counties begin to provide pretrial assessment and supervision of these people accused of or facing charges. This provides for the assessment of those folks in our county jails, and develops supervision strategies to be able to manage them in the community, which those with resources would normally participate in through the use of bail. And we do this by using validated assessment tools that it also ensures the protection of the community as we do this. This comes with about an $8 million cost over the biennium. But we believe it is a part of really looking at corrections more systemically, how we manage offenders from the time they enter the system all the way through to reentry, and what we hope and what we work toward is pro-social reintegration. Intensive supervised release. Intensive supervised release has been around for some period of time. Intensive supervised release provides agents to go out and provide around-the-clock supervision of these people at various different times of the night and the day. These offenders are oftentimes people who have a highest risk for violence and oftentimes have the highest need. They can include predatory offenders. And with ISR or intensive supervised release, there are statutory requirements in terms of caseload size because the legislature saw when this was developed the need for that to be intensive, for that to be focused so that we could ensure community safety through sound supervision. These agents oftentimes work in partnership with one another. There's two agents who do this, and what this budget request would do, again, just shy of $10 million over the biennium, it improves the ISR agent's safety. They can work in pairs, and it better addresses the broad range of needs, increases our ability to add put people out on ISR. And ultimately, if one of our strategies is to reduce our population, one of the ways we can help do that is by restructuring people who may have had a technical violation in the community to a period of intensive supervision. This also invests in safety supplies, such as radios, that can be used in areas where there is no cell phone coverage. And this really is an important, as many of you know, my previous life was as a police chief just recently in Invergrove Heights, and their Dakota County agents who were working intensive supervision had access to a police radio. They would check out on calls, and the officers throughout the county were aware of where they were in the event that there would be a problem. And it was just really sound practice and really important for the safety of the agents and really the safety of the community. This includes, included in this is not simply the DOC, but there is a significant portion of dollars that are pass-through dollars that go out to Community Corrections Act counties who are providing this supervision in the community, and it provides the services as well, both in the metro area as well as outstate. Victim notification and juvenile correctional records management system. This really is about the replacement and rebuilding of systems that are outdated, and we all know, I think, the importance of corrections in terms of the work with victims. Part of the business of justice is ensuring that victims feel like they have a voice, that they know what's happening. And for many victims, wanting to have and receive the information, which I would add is a right by Minnesota law, this system becomes necessary. This is an investment of dollars in rebuilding a system that has that it was antiquated and discontinued operation, and allows victims to opt in, to register, and to receive notifications in the event of a change of placement of an offender, which we believe is fundamentally empowering. In addition to that, these dollars also address upgrades to the juvenile management system, which is really the records management system, and does a better job of connecting this system to the DOC's central comms system. This becomes necessary because right now this system is operating off of very old technology, and not something that can be sustained over the long haul. Electronic monitoring and transitional housing for high-risk offenders. We know that effective monitoring and housing does become important elements of reducing recidivism and maximizing community safety. Over the last several years, there has been a significant increase in the use of electronic monitoring and transitional housing because oftentimes When some of these offenders are released from our facilities, they simply cannot access housing. Electronic monitoring becomes one of the keys that we manage those offenders that are of highest risk. And the ability to access some forms of transitional housing in the community is a way of getting people out of our facilities in accordance with the law and managing them in the community and being able to more adequately supervise them while they're out, which obviously becomes an important part of our mission and really our responsibility to the people of Minnesota. These dollars would help us, we believe, also when it comes to addressing some of the churn that ultimately affects officer safety within our facilities, as well as the safety of residents inside of our facilities. Because of the number of short-term returnees that are coming back into our facilities, we think that some of these dollars can help us to manage those people in the community in a better way through electronic monitoring or through accessing some of the transitional housing programs or halfway house programs that we currently utilize, but we could potentially be more effective in managing the use of those beds with these dollars. Corrections opioid treatment provisions. This, as many of you know, is really part of the overall opioid package that both the Senate and the House have been discussing. We know that an increasing number of people are coming into the Department of Corrections with opioid addiction, and we need to have a broader range of tools to address this. What this does is it invests in pre-release planning services, and the establishment and maximization of our treatment programs targeted at opioid addiction and the use of medication-assisted treatment options within the facilities. And I believe several of the county jails are initiating this as well, because the number of people that are leaving our facilities and die as a result of opioid addiction is a very real and present issue, and this is a method of being able to manage that. Finally, we talk about reducing recidivism through connecting families and reentry programs. This is really a $2 million investment over the course of the biennium. This invests in transportation services to reduce visiting barriers for children of incarcerated offenders. We know that as long the more connection there is between offenders, those who are incarcerated, and their families, in particular their children, the less likely they are to recidivate. And this becomes one of the important tools. We also need to recognize that we know that upon release, having adequate community-based supports becomes an important feature of success. Ultimately, we believe providing services to be able to keep these families together, to be able to keep the families of incarcerated offenders visiting, maintaining that relationship becomes a core component of successful reintegration and reentry. Second component of this is improving parenting skills for incarcerated parents. One of the things that I found remarkable when I arrived at the Department of Corrections was some of the feedback we received from people who had been released from prison. And one of the most demanded programs was an interest in parenting programs. And I think that's it's critically important as we think about how it is that we break the cycle of offending and that can happen within families. This becomes one of the key ways to address that. And what this does is it provides dollars for parenting skills programming that is evidence-based and is effective at helping these offenders when they get back into the community more effectively parent and become part and parcel to keeping their children out of the very system that they're leaving. And then finally, I just left this afternoon the meeting of the MIAC, the tribal with the tribes, and certainly one of the areas of interest for them was ensuring a commitment on behalf of Minnesota and the Department of Corrections in this case, that we would honor and recognize what oftentimes we think is the need to provide highly culturally specific services to incarcerated Native Americans in our facilities. We oftentimes think that the best way to do things is the way we believe we should do things. And I think ultimately when we think about Native Americans in our facilities, to be smart, to be culturally responsive, I think is a reflection of our desire to make sure that our system is as equitable as it can be, and to be able to make an investment of having Native American programs that are exist in our communities to provide services to Native American offenders before they release and upon their release becomes one of the key and critical issues, we think, to addressing the profound disparities that exist with Native Americans in the criminal justice system in general. And with that, chairs and committee members, I would open it up to questions.
Thank you, Commissioner Snell. And I just actually have a comment. This afternoon I learned about a program in Michigan for reentry in which they are connecting the residents as they are leaving with their local community health centers, setting up an appointment within the first week to establish primary care, but then also to have a continuity of care, particularly as it comes to behavioral medicine. And like I said, just heard about that this afternoon. I'm not sure how fast we can get something together for that, maybe a pilot program, but I really liked it. Also, I'm very interested in the parenting program. If I may, 1991, I won the statewide award for jail programs with a parenting program in Blue Earth County. So it's something that, yeah, I've had interest in for some time. I can see Representative O'Neill is now bending her microphone. So, Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's actually to that point. I happen to know that there used to be a bus that went around and picked up the kids and brought them to the prisons. But that program ended, and can you explain why it ended? And I know a nonprofit, maybe some churches or something, had done the same thing, and they also came into the same difficulty. So can you explain what actually happened and why that program was ended?
Mr. Chair, Representative O'Neill, the exact reason I can't, but I know that part of it was based on some funding. Ultimately, I think we need to make a commitment to this, because this is really an important and key proven strategy around reconnection. And I believe that in many cases, some of that was continued because of the kind of philanthropic efforts of some of the nonprofits who are providing those services. But after a period of time, it becomes difficult for them to continue to do that. And I think over the course of time, based on some of the historical data that I've looked at, there has been changes and desires to look at a range of different programming, and oftentimes we forget about the most basic of services, and that is keeping these families together. And to your point, I think we need to make a commitment. I think that's reflected in the budget to try to keep these families together during incarceration.
Thank you.
Representative O'Neill, you have a follow-up?
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was understanding that they didn't have any kids to pick up, that the kids just didn't have interest, or they couldn't get anyone to actually come to the prisons. Is that accurate?
Mr. Chair, Representative O'Neill, I believe that one of the things that we know was that there had some of the challenges that they faced was the ability to kind of connect with. When there was services that were reaching out to the families, to the moms or the dads or grandparents or whoever the children were living with, when those arrangements were made and there was strong connections made, the young people did access those services. One of the things that I think has become clear is that in the absence of good wraparound services, and that's one of the things that with this program we would like to see included, is that there is a level of support for making arrangements for those kids to be able to get out and visit their incarcerated parents, but also to process what that experience is like when they leave. Because I think we all know what it can mean for some of us to be inside those facilities. I can only imagine how difficult it could be for young people. But we have to be the ones to help make that happen. And I think that's what this program would include.
Another follow-up, yes. Representative O'Neill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Commissioner Schnell. I would just caution that if we're going to do this again, that we have a good plan in place so that we actually have kids to pick up and, you know, we don't put all that money into it and they don't actually want to come or are aware of it. Or I'm not sure exactly what happened, but I know that there weren't kids actually to pick up and that's why the program ended. On another question, though, you know, I was the chair of the Subcommittee on Employee Relations and had the opportunity to review 18 of the state employee contracts. And in so doing, looking back at the historical information, I found that one contract alone out of those 18, the information provided to the SCR as to how much that contract would cost was actually off by 40%. And so when that money was actually spent and that contract was actually implemented across the board, it was a 40% increase, more than what was anticipated. And I'm seeing something in your budget proposal that sort of speaks to that, and that was something that we had great concern about. And I actually asked the former commissioner, well, he's now the commissioner again, Commissioner Franz, if he could commit to the Subcommittee on Employee Relations that he in fact had talked to the commissioners to make sure that these increases could be absorbed within the budgets already passed, and he assured me that they could. But now I'm seeing that that's not actually true. I see $28 million that you are, you know, and it's interesting to me that it's $28 million and we haven't hired the 80. So I'm not sure how that all calculates in that, you know, we had appropriated for 80 more corrections officers. So can you just speak to that? And it's really a great concern that the contracts are looked at not as deeply as they probably should so that we can do proper budgeting when we come to here. And so I think my concern is that we do proper budgeting here so we really know what the contracts are going to cost and that whatever parameters that we set, the contracts are actually negotiated within those parameters. And historically, they have not been. And so I'm bringing that to your attention and see if you have a comment about that as well.
Mr. Chair, Representative O'Neill, one of the things that was, to be honest, it was eye-opening for me was the fact that in many of the governments that I've worked at prior, mostly municipal governments, that when there was an authorized staffing strength, that was projected, the costs were projected over the course of the term of employment. That is not how the state budgets in terms of this. They establish the budget on a number of FTEs for a biennium or for a given period of time. And a lot of the cost tails that go along with that employment in accordance with the contract, whether that step increases or changes to pension, are not factored. And what ends up happening then is if you have, and I'm just going to use a number to make it simple, if we have an authorized strength of 100 and we don't factor the entire life of the contract of those 100 employees, that essentially what happens here is that we are coming in and having to ask for, it oftentimes in arrears of, actions that we simply aren't a part of. That changes in policy, whether that's on the pension side or on healthcare costs, come up after a budget gets set. And to be frank, that's going to happen potentially again, depending upon the outcomes of collective bargaining that is going on now. that we are going to, this contract does not make any assumptions for increases in any increases in collective bargaining that may happen going forward. And so ultimately, the Department of Corrections finds itself in a position of oftentimes having to play catch up.
Just one final comment.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate your deference. So that would be my concern and my caution, that you would be very closely connected to those that are actually negotiating the budgets that you have to live within. That's something that hasn't been done historically as I look back through, biennium after biennium. And we are in the exact same position as you just stated, that these contracts are negotiated and the legislature is told that the contracts fall within the parameters of the budget already passed, when in fact they don't. And then you come back and say, I need $28 million more, or, it depends on the agency, $100 million, it's hundreds of millions of dollars more than what was anticipated. So my ask is that you would stick very closely to Commissioner Franz and make sure that we have those contracts negotiated within the parameters of what we're passing here, because it's just a cyclical thing that's happening, biennium after biennium after biennium. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative O'Neill. And I would tell you that we are looking at a program for a bus to take children. But your second part of your budget, I have some concerns about the budget, and I want to look at it a little bit closer and make sure that everything spells out. But we are looking at a program that would take children to Shakopee and reconnect them with their mothers. Representative Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for coming here tonight, Commissioner. I'm looking at my different things here, and I'm sort of new to this, so I have a question, if you could probably point me to it. On the county pass-through funding on your supplemental sheets, with the CCA, the way I understand it, I had some people come and talk to me in my office, and that's the subsidy to those 34 counties that essentially help with probation services. Is that correct?
That's correct.
What is the proposed increase in that? In the next biennium, I'm not quite. I think it's in this book, but I'm not quite finding how it's divided out. So, go ahead,
Mr. Chair and Representative Miller.
Yep.
Okay. So two of our components do include funding for pass through to the counties. One of them is, and bear with me here while I find it.
This is in my budget book.
Right. One of them is for the pretrial assessment and supervision. That does include $1.75 million in fiscal year 20 and $3.5 million in fiscal year 21 to go to CCA and CPO counties.
Okay.
And then the other one is intensive supervised release, and that includes approximately $2 million in fiscal year 20 and $4 million in fiscal year 21 to go to CCA counties. The percentage we use is approximately DOC is the recipient of about 36% of these funds, and the county partners are a recipient of about 64% of the funding.
Okay, Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Miller,
actually,
you have a follow-up?
Someone afterwards can point where this is. I mean, I know it's in here, but I still didn't find it. Just rough, what's the percentage increase on those? Over the next biennium, just rough.
Boy, the total pass-through funding now is about $75 million. Mm-hmm. This would increase it by about $7.5 million a year, so probably okay. About 10% okay. Overall.
Thank you.
Just comment on that it also comes with the new responsibilities, too, for the CCA counties. Just if that's your concern.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, then one final comment on that.
Okay, go ahead.
So I know some probation service people, and they're, I'm sure you know this way better than I do, but those are stress services at this time. And those are if we're going to put a point of emphasis in our system on the probationary side of it, we need to make sure that we certainly have that. I hear phrases like, drive-by probationary services and things like that, because you just can't keep up with the sheer number of people with with the resources available. So if we're going to put an ever-increasing emphasis on probation services as opposed to incarceration, just make sure that the budgets reflect that. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Miller. Yeah. Representative Edelson.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Chair, Commissioner. So for prison security and safety, you have allotted $20 million in fiscal year 20. I see that it was great to see the correction officers here here today. That's good. I see 120 correctional officers, but how about for on page 13, the third bullet down, increased caseworkers and behavioral staff? I mean, I imagine you're a social worker. You know, I met a lot of these people in the prisons have underlying mental health issues. I know that you're doing a pretty good job in treating them, but how, in this budget, how many more behavioral workers and staff are you anticipating adding with that?
So in, Mr. Chair, Representative, in this proposal, we are looking to increase, let's find it here, in our case management area, there is the expansion of staff to the tune of, is it 24? 24 additional FTEs for case management and support services in the facilities to work with and manage the needs of these offenders.
Representative Edelson, you have a follow-up?
Thank you, Chair. Yes. So for the 24 of the prisons, will they equally be divided? How will that work in terms of staffing?
The exact allocation, Representative, will be identified based upon need, and we have some facilities where there is a significantly higher need in terms of when I talk about need, I'm talking about risk and need, because ultimately we want to make sure that we're applying those resources to the offenders that have the highest risk and the highest criminogenic need.
Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Representative Zerwas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the Commissioner. Thank you for coming this evening and presenting to the committee. Commissioner, there's a pretty big gap between what we have as a requested correctional officer request coming from the majority party bill, and I'm a co-author on the bill, and from what's coming down in the governor's budget. I'm just wondering, I think we talked about this a little bit this morning, but for individuals that weren't able to be there, part of that discussion, if you could elaborate on kind of what's being brought forward from the representatives of the line employees versus what's coming down in the budget from the governor's office and the department, if you could address that difference.
Mr. Chair, Representative Zerwas, yes, I think when we looked at this, we factored in the current vacancies that we have and wanted to be really realistic about what we believe we can actually hire and get into the facilities. We think that was first and foremost. The other thing I would point out is that the GOM bill is over two bienniums. The proposed is a single. And I think really it became important for us to really think about what we could realistically do. There is no doubt, and we've had this discussion before about the need that exists. The question really is, we did not want to come in and make an ask that we did not believe that we could satisfy in a meaningful way.
Representative Zerwas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to that point about being able to fill the positions that you're authorized to hire for, if you could recap for the Joint Committee the number of current openings and the strategy to fill the current openings that you can't have yet been unable to fill.
Mr. Chair, Representative Zerwas, I think when we looked at this issue, there's a whole variety of factors that we are taking into account. First and foremost, one of the things that we need to do is really look at the competitiveness of us as an employer with correctional officers. As we've talked about before in the committee, many of the counties are bringing people in at between $3 to $5, $6, $7 an hour more than where our COs are starting. In order to attract and retain those dollars become important. Now, let me be clear. Working for the state and working for the Department of Corrections is a great career. And over the course of a lifetime, I think the earnings are good. The benefits are good. But ultimately, in order to attract and retain, we really need to make to bring people in. The second thing that we realized is that over the course of time, in particular when the job market was very different, we would have hundreds of people applying for a very small number of openings. But today, we find ourselves that flipped. We have, in many cases, 100-plus openings across the DOC in general, and very few applicants. So one of the things that we began to look at is, are there ways that we could bring people on quicker while maintaining kind of high levels of standards around who we bring in the door? And by working with HR and MMB, we are in the process of devising a plan and really executing this plan where we would do more facility-based recruitment and hiring that would allow people who may be from that given community or broader region to come into that facility, apply for employment, learn more about the job itself, fill out their application, go through an interview process, and potentially even have the first phase of background investigation completed. And so that instead of it taking, in some cases, several months to bring somebody on, that we could have somebody have a conditional offer for employment potentially within days. And then once the conditions have been met, we could bring them in to a facility-based training experience that ultimately we believe connects them, gives them that necessary experience even before they start the academy in some instances, so they're not waiting 6 weeks or whatever it may be to get into that academy. We think expediting this process will go a long way, but it's going to require the totality of approaches in order to make this successful.
Representative Zerwas, would you have a follow-up by any chance?
A few. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I love the approach. I love the change in the approach, the expediency. And in this job market, you're right, competitors are offering jobs at a much quicker rate than DOC was previously able to compete with. But what are the actual openings that have been kind of out there? I mean, we're talking about bringing on an additional 120 officers, and I guess my point is we can talk about raising the authorized amount till we're blue in the face. We're already sitting on dozens and dozens and dozens of CO positions that you just can't hire for.
Right. Representative Zerwas, you're right. We would need to, over the course of the remainder of this biennium through the next, hire 200 correctional officers. And the only way that we could do that realistically was to begin to change some of our processes, and we believe the plan we have will help do that. We are going to begin to reach out more heavily with the schools, the colleges. Representative O'Neill talked about that this morning. We're really working to diversify our correctional officer workforce, and we believe, much like reaching out to the kids who may benefit from visiting their parents, we have to be more high touch today in order to bring people in the door, and I think that's our plan. That's the strategy to accomplish that goal.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Zerwas.
I'm wondering, Commissioner, if off the top of your head or with a phone a friend, you can tell the committee for a line officer how many years it takes to get to the top correctional officer pay scale. Because when I found out about this, I was pretty stunned.
Mr. Chair, Representative Zerwas, I've heard a lot about this in my visits. I'll be the first to tell you the exact number of years I can't say, but many people talked about it could take more than a decade to
12.
To get to top of scale. And again, this becomes, I think, one of the important considerations that obviously is a subject of to some level of collective bargaining. But ultimately, one of the things that happened in my previous work in law enforcement, one of the ways we managed retention of people was to try and shorten the scale to bring people up to the top quicker.
And Mr. Chair, that's kind of my point. I think the commissioner alluded to it. And my next question was going to be, in your previous line of work, what was the longest that any of your police officers had to get to top patrol? I've never heard of a department over 7 years. Most nowadays are 5 years to get to top patrol. The idea that our corrections officers are in position for over a decade, I've heard 12 or 13 years, to get to the top of the pay scale, what that ends up creating is it creates corrections officers that are in for 3 or 5 years of training that the state pays for to get pulled out to a county jail at still about a $5 to $7 an hour raise on day one. We train them, we get them experience, we get them ready, and the county jails take them because our scale is so long to get them to the top. Who's going to sit in the same position for 12 years to get to the top of the pay scale? That's not realistic. And so we can budget money to hire another 120 correctional officers. And if we factor in the number of openings that we have currently, as the commissioner said, that means we have to hire 200 officers to hit that mark. Even if we do that, if we don't address this pay scale, we're not going to keep them. One last question, if you'll indulge me. Mr. Commissioner, what's your retention rate of COs?
So we have done some looking at a retention. So I'll give you just a little bit of an example. Of the correctional officers hired in calendar year 18, 78% of those were still employed on January 24th of 19. Now, again, this is a little bit shorter a period of time. And ultimately, when we begin to think about this, that about 78%, we're losing somewhere around between 20 and 25% of the people that we're hiring. And I think, this was eye-opening for me. In the first half of this fiscal year, 7/1/18 to 12/31, 151 COs were hired. That's a lot of hiring. But to your point, we know that one of our challenges is that we oftentimes lose many of these people either very early on, or I think we too are concerned about losing that 2 year or 3 year officer who we've made an investment in, and obviously one of the things that we need to do is address this to make this. A job that is competitive throughout the market, and I think really reflects the importance of the work.
Yeah, Representative Rojas, while I share your passion, and I'm not normally one for a lot of protocol, let's try to get back.
Well, Mr. Chair, I guess the last thing I would say
is
the numbers that I saw at 5 years have a five-year retention, a loss rate of nearly a third. And so we're investing a lot of money in training individuals that just flat aren't sticking around because their entry-level pay is not enough. But the idea that this pay scale is stretched out over 12 years, it doesn't work. It just doesn't work. And so unless there is a concerted effort moving forward by the Department of Corrections to address that portion of it, saying we're going to hire an additional 120 people doesn't much make sense.
And Representative Zerwas, again, appreciate your passion, and we are on the same page with that. But I will try to get things back on a little bit more of a the correct protocol. I know I've not ever been one that's been terribly good about it. You have something else you want to add,
Chair,
Commissioner?
Just to Representative Zerwas's point, I do believe, and I say this in all honesty, that I do believe that that we can make these hires. I think it's necessary for us to make them for the good and well-being of our facilities and for our staff. I do believe that you know, the department, we certainly would like to raise the pay of everyone. But I think ultimately we also are in a position where we have to honor the collective bargaining process and the agreements that get forged. And ultimately, I think the attention that's been given to corrections by this committee and the attention in general, given the deaths of Officers Gum and Parisi, I think raise the specter of the importance of this as we go forward. And I think collectively there is a need to address this, but I do believe that we can get there.
Thank you, Commissioner. Representative Christensen.
Thank you, Chair. Am I on here? Is it on? Okay. I have a question about programming. We haven't talked about that much. So where does funding for programming fall into all of this? And, you know, obviously there's going to be funding needs for the programming itself and then for the staff that you need for programming. So I know I've spoken quite a bit with the education folks in the Stillwater system, and they could sure use a lot of help, I think, too, in programming. So just curious where that falls into this whole pie chart that we have here.
Mr. Chair, Representative Christensen, thank you. I think one of the things that happens, one of the challenges that we face right now is, we've talked about before, nothing happens in a prison facility without security. We can't move people to programming. We believe that with adequate security staffing, we do have the ability to expand the capacity for people to access programming today, even educationally. We could grow the numbers of people that we provide educational services to. But in order for that to happen, we need to make sure that we bolster, in particular in those in facilities like Stillwater. Where there's adequate staffing to get the inmates to the programming and to provide supports to education staff or other program staff, treatment staff, as a for instance, while they're in those programs. So we do believe we have some capacity there to expand the number of inmates that can access those programs, but we need the security staff in order to do that safely.
Thank you, Commissioner. Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Kind of back to the retention issue. This was a conversation you and I had in my office, and I had a few corrections officers come in and kind of tell me their day-to-day life and how challenging it is. But one of the things that we talked about was management and leadership style, and it's something that we haven't talked about much in here, but it relates directly to retention, and since we do have a retention issue and it's going to be challenging to hire that many folks, can you just talk about your plan about helping the leaders and the management do a little bit better job and helping them to be more supportive, I think, of the corrections officers that they do supervise?
Mr. Chair, Representative O'Neill, yes, I think this is an area I think that we are given significant emphasis to at the department. We've been just meeting with wardens and all the staff to talk about really what the importance, what the objectives are, and that is to ensure and work toward the success of all the people that we have contact with. And that's certainly the leadership objective standard that I want to apply to myself to ensure the success of others as well throughout the ranks. And that becomes important. There's no doubt that the work of correction staff is exceedingly difficult. And I think that we're in an environment, and I saw some of this in my previous life in law enforcement, where there was the need to, one, have really high standards for the people who do this work, and at the same time to ensure that we're providing equally high levels of support, encouragement, seeing and having to deal with the things that correctional staff across the board, our nurses, our treatment staff, our case managers, our COs deal with on a day-to-day basis is really tough. And I think one of the things that we are exploring and have been working with the collective bargaining units on is addressing some of the needs of people from this, just from the standpoint of officer and staff wellness. And this is an area that we have to do better because I think it is part and parcel to retention. And so it's a comprehensive package in terms of what we expect of leadership and the way we look at leadership within the Department of Corrections. But it also is being very concrete about the fact that this is tough work and we don't want people taking this stuff home to their families because it can be tough enough without bringing it home to them.
Thank you, Commissioner. Did you have another follow-up?
Just one last small little question, just 30 seconds.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the last question is just about the opioid prevention, and you're going to be using money from the opioid stewardship fund. If it's created, what are you going to do if it's not created?
Mr. Chair, Representative O'Neill, while certainly we would hope that there's a comprehensive approach to addressing the issues around opioid use, addiction, and all of the medical things that come as a result of it, what we will have to do is do the best we can. That with our existing medical staff, we will do everything we can to provide the necessary treatment services. But the reality is to meet the demands of the number of people that are coming into our facilities that are afflicted with this addiction is a demand that I think will have implications in other areas of our medical and treatment care of people in our facilities. So I think it becomes incumbent upon us to think about the ways that we ultimately address the needs. Simply put, I think it's tragic to have people leave prison after whatever period of incarceration it is, and know that for some of these particular offenders, that they will die shortly after their release without much needed intervention. And I think there's a moral obligation for us to provide services that we think will make a difference.
Just to follow up.
You promised. No. Representative O'Neill.
Just something that as we're doing budgeting, we're getting to the final nuts and bolts of things and into final negotiations, just something to think of as you're working on the budget, that if the stewardship fund doesn't go into effect for some reason, as we're doing the last bit, that maybe you want to hold aside a few dollars just to help them out, because I think in the long run you're going to have a big impact.
Thank you, Representative O'Neill, and I think Chair Murray and I are both open up to that idea. And to your previous question, I am going to be meeting with some custody officers next week to talk about some supports that we might institute. You're right, they need some more support on a regular basis, and we should be looking at giving that to them. I have one request, actually came from the audience. If somebody from your staff could tell me about programs for print disabled people and what opportunities there might be in higher education, and if they could get that to me, I would get it to the person that asked me. Are there any more questions or comments? Representative Zerwas, one more? No. Just pulling your leg. Okay. Okay. If that's okay. If that's it, then we're adjourned.